This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.
Say it loud, say it clear. Trump is not welcome here.
And hello, Cincinnati. Very, very special on the banks of the beautiful Ohio River with the hardworking patriots of the American heartland. Thank you, Ohio. We love you, Ohio.
President Trump said his supporters created a record-breaking crowd at U.S. Bank Arena as his 2020 re-election campaign marched through Cincinnati. He was met by protesters outside, and one violent skirmish led to multiple arrests. And meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence stopped by a Northern Kentucky Skyline Chili and didn't eat. The Friday News Review begins with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Scott Wortman. Welcome back, Scott.
Well, thanks for having me.
And WVXU reporter and host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Welcome, Bill.
Good afternoon.
Join our conversation at 513-419-7100. Give us your perspective on what you saw here in Cincinnati on Thursday when the president and the vice president and their team rolled into town. You can email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So leading up to this rally, there were questions about whether the crowd would erupt into chants of send her back, as a North Carolina crowd did at a Trump rally. In relation to Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, she'd been criticized by the president on Twitter, told to go back to where she came from if she didn't like America, and then learn how to do it and make America better when she comes back. But we didn't hear that chant in Cincinnati. And I'm curious if any of Trump's followers had anything to say about that before or after.
Yeah, the people I talked to at the rally and some of Trump's campaign people were very self-conscious of the fact that if they did that, the Democrats would pounce on it. So there was a heightened sense of anxiety. The people in the crowd did not want that chant to break out, as well as Trump did say he also didn't want he didn't want to instigate anything, anything like that. So it did seem like, which is kind of surprising for a large crowd, there was probably about 17,000 people there, although I don't have an official count. But the fact that, you know, everyone in that crowd did seem to be cognizant of the fact that they did not want to specifically hit that hot button.
Did you talk to anybody on this subject matter, Bill?
I talked to a few people beforehand. I talked to a couple of women from Kentucky who were not bothered by it. They said, you know, what we want is legal immigration. And there's a lot of people we don't believe are here legally, and we want them to be sent back.
Two people, though, that I did talk to specifically said they felt that was a distraction and that would pretty much play in the Trump's hands. So they specifically did not want to say those words.
It did seem interesting that this is what the national media outlets were waiting to see if that happened. I saw a banner on CNN that said no send her back chant yet.
All the stories were like, will they say it?
Yeah. And I think that's probably one. I mean, you know, that's easy target for commentary. So perhaps that was what they were hoping to get. Mm-hmm. But also, there's not really a whole lot of new things in terms of substance that come out of these rallies. He's got his talking points down, and we don't hear a whole lot of new things. So did we hear anything new?
He did say at the end he was going to cure AIDS and pediatric cancer, which I don't know where that came from. And then he went on to something else after that. So that was new.
That did strike me as new, but there wasn't really any like substantive policy position behind that. It was more just like empty rhetoric.
We're going to do it. We're going to go to Mars.
Yeah.
We're going to cure cancer.
It was a long speech, too. It was an hour and a half. And by the hour mark, people started leaving just because they had gotten worn out. It was a noticeably thinner crowd by the time he finished. That last half hour was a bit too long for a lot of his ardent supporters even.
Well, let's talk about the crowd briefly, because the president did say, you know, and he is quite bombastic, so everything's always the best and the biggest when the president is involved. And he did say that this rally set a record for attendance at U.S. Bank Arena. And I'm wondering if we fact check that.
I don't have confirmation from the arena yet. I've called them. They've not responded. The fire department did tell me this morning that it was capacity, and capacity is about 17,000 there. And the record was a Metallica concert. I forget exactly what year, a couple years ago.
Yeah, just
I thought it was
a couple years.
The article I looked up to today from the Inquirer, I thought
just
was dated
year.
This year.
And that was like 16,900. So it's very possible it was a record one day event at the arena. I don't have confirmation from the arena on that, but it could be. Yeah.
This was definitely bigger than his last appearance at U.S. Bank Arena. That was in December of 2016 as he was kicking off a victory tour around the country. It was obvious from the very start that this was a bigger crowd because the upper sections, there were people in there. And back in 2016, those were empty.
And when it started, yeah, I mean, every seat was filled at the beginning. And
the floor was crowded.
Yeah.
And in that last half hour of it, started noticing more and more empty seats up in the stands and noticed people weren't jostled quite so much out in front of the podium.
A lot of those people had been in line for hours, too, yeah, before that. So, yeah.
So I think that can be read as a bit of enthusiasm, mm-hmm, on the side of President Trump, as we've, yeah, seen a lot of focus on the Democratic primary because of the debates that have been going on. And I guess now we know that there is still some energy on the right as well. So the attendance for that Metallica concert was 16,587, which, mm, is the official record until we find out officially how many people were at the Trump rally. That Metallica concert passed up Eric Church and Garth Brooks, who come in at second and third, just for the record.
I'll contact the Guinness people tonight.
Appreciate
that. And I'm not talking about the world record, folks.
All right. Okay, so there was a mild disruption in the middle of the event that got some attention because the president, yes, did come to a halt with his remarks, and then we didn't really get a sense of it on television, but you guys were there about what was happening. What was going on during this disruption, Bill?
Off to stage left, that would be to the left of the president, there was a small group of about maybe five people where they held up a couple of banners. Let me find exactly where it happened.
Do we have some sound from inside the arena, or is it from outside, Josh? It's from outside. It's from Bill. I'm sorry, Bill. I know that you wanted us to include some sound.
Oh, we can get to that. We can get to that later.
But my apologies. I thought it was related to this.
No, that was completely separate. But at one point, I can't find in my notes exactly when it happened. There was a small group of people, four or five people, suddenly held up some banners that said "Immigrants Built America," and there was a banner that was made to look like bars, like the bars of a cage or a prison. And they got enough noise going just among them to the president stopped. For a full 3.5 minutes, he stopped talking and looked over and watched them. And the rest of the crowd actually got a little quieter. And they went on for a bit. There was a little bit of back and forth between them and the people immediately around them. One of them got their one of the immigration demonstrators got their banner ripped out of their hands. This went on for about 3.5 minutes or so before they were finally escorted out.
Yeah, it did feel like a long time, Scott, watching on television, yeah, not knowing exactly what was happening because the cameras, I don't know if they located exactly what was going on. So it just seemed like this weird thing happening.
The police there did let them chant for a while. They just stood there, I guess, trying to assess the situation. And then eventually when it didn't stop, then they escorted them out. It didn't look like there was some jostling among Trump supporters and the protesters. But it didn't look like they resisted the police. They left walking out voluntarily. Well, you know, there wasn't a scuffle between police and the protesters.
Yeah, this happened about 31 minutes into the president's – well, actually about 10 minutes into the president's speech. And it started once he started talking about borders. He accused Democrats of wanting open borders. He talked about how Mexico has stepped up and increased its military presence on the border to cut illegal immigration from the south to the United States. And that's when these demonstrators erupted, went on for about 3 minutes, and Trump came back with, you must have a Democratic mayor here in Cincinnati.
Exactly. I had that to ask you about because he, you know, made a reference to the Democrat mayor situation. But mostly, as far as local politicos are concerned, he had praise for his fellow Republicans and praise for Cincinnati and Ohio. Is that right, Scott?
Yeah, yeah. And he had he brought with him on Air Force One Steve Chabot, Rob Portman, Brad Wenstrup. Mike DeWine introduced Mike Pence, the vice president, although Mike DeWine did not get as healthy of a reception as the president and vice president. There were a few jeers in the audience when he took the stage. But no, Trump did a lightning round where he lauded all the local Republican politicians. And it was kind of funny that He made sure, like, he asked whether Cincinnati had a Democratic mayor before criticizing the city. Like, wait a minute. It is a Democratic mayor, right?
But he also had nice things to say about Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin, who met him at the airport. And I believe he said he would come do a rally for Bevin, who's
he
up for re-election.
He said, get a big arena ready. He's going to hold a rally for Matt Bevin. So
it sounds like either Louisville or Lexington may be a future site of a Trump rally on behalf of Matt Bevin. There was a fight outside the arena, and the circumstances seem a little bit unclear. There is a video circulating of this, but it starts with a man getting out of who had gotten out of a truck and then took a swing at a Trump protester.
Yes.
What do we know about this situation?
We don't know the motivation of the man that was arrested. They say online he was a Trump supporter, but we don't have any actual concrete confirmation of that. But he was in a truck. The truck stopped. He gets out. He does kind of like some old-fashioned fisticuffs-like motion and then goes, you want some? And then all of a sudden just starts swinging at this protester outside.
He did get a few blows in on this man.
Yeah.
And it did look like he had suffered some injuries, although even this man who was involved noted that he did not go down in some of the reporting that I read about this particular incident. So the man who threw the punches, and it looked like the person who had been driving the truck were at least escorted away by police. We know that the man who threw the punches was booked into jail.
Yes.
So somebody was arrested at this. I also wanted to reference a piece of reporting from the Huffington Post. This is a quote from their story. Protesters weren't the only source of the crowd's animosity Thursday night. Before Trump took the stage, a large white man lingered by the designated press area, leaning over the gate, looking menacingly at reporters. He then pointed at certain reporters and made a slicing motion across his neck. The man also made the shape of a gun with his thumb and two fingers, pretending to take a weapon out of his pocket. Confronted by a HuffPost reporter about the threats, the man wouldn't identify himself and then basically said all the reporters should be thrown in jail for treason, for fake news, except for Fox. Did either of you witness that in the press?
I was in a different press pen, so I did not see that.
I did not see this particular fellow, I don't think. It's hard to say because every one of these rallies I've gone to, there's always been multiple people giving the press area the stink eye. They all glare at us, and I did not see anyone making any overt or even covert threats.
I mean, I didn't either from the one. I had a few people that were kind of joking with us, but there weren't – I did not get menaced personally.
And another difference from previous rallies is there was not the whole fake news chant like it has been in previous times. Previous times, everyone turns around, stares at you, shouts fake news, and whatever. That really didn't happen last night.
No, we didn't. We didn't even get booed.
Yeah.
It seemed then that the crowd wanted to be on its best behavior because of the hyper attention that this particular rally was getting in the wake of that North Carolina situation.
I don't want to give motivation to 17,000 different people.
That's fair.
That's smart.
But you did bring some sound back for us to listen to. Can you set this up for us?
Well, before the event, I wandered around, talked to some people who were going in, talked to some people who were not going in. And I've got two guys here. Neither one wanted to give their name. One we'll call Jim, the other one Jacob. And I asked them both pretty much the same question. What would you like to tell someone on the other side of the aisle?
Well, I think they need to release their fears and their hate, and then they'll see that there's actually nothing for them to be afraid of.
What do you mean?
Well, they're afraid that something's going to be taken from them, and there's nothing that's ever been taken from them by Trump, and their fears of a bad future are unfounded, that if anything is making the future more brighter, it's policies of the president.
Treat others as the way you want to be treated. That didn't fit on the sign, but that's the rest of it.
Yeah, the first guy was Jim from Anderson Township, I believe he was from. He was there with his son, longtime Trump supporter, he said. He was on his way to U.S. Bank Arena. I found him in front of the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, where there was supposed to be a big Trump counter demonstration. This was a little after 4 o'clock, and he was wondering where the demonstrators were. And then over in front of Great American Ballpark, Jacob, he and a friend were wearing big sandwich board signs with basically the message, God is love, God loves them. And I asked him, who is the them? He says, it's pretty much the other, anyone who is not you. And he was just trying to get that message out.
What did you gather as the overall feeling of the arena? Because as we noted at the beginning, the president has pretty much said at least most of his remarks before. Do the supporters of the president, do they seem excited? Were they fully engaged?
Yeah.
For the most of it.
Yeah.
And I think he started to lose them towards the end because he went for 90 minutes and he just kind of kept going and going and going. And we talk about how the crowd started to thin out. Those who were staying, they weren't as loud. They weren't as boisterous as they usually are. And it's hard to keep up that kind of energy level for 90 minutes. And
I don't think he lost votes in the arena,
though.
It just, they got very tired at the end. And they had been in line for hours, too. So.
And the vice president, Mike Pence, he paid a visit to town. He stopped by the Skyline Chili location in Fort Wright. I read that he only ordered a drink. He didn't eat the local cuisine. How bad does this hurt their reelection chances, Scott?
Well, it's a big question. Like, who just goes to Skyline and gets a Pepsi? And I saw a lot of chatter on, like who drinks Pepsi? Even. Yeah.
You really can't win in this age of partisanship, can you?
No, you can't. Yeah.
But we also wanted to note that the vice president did speak at U.S. Bank Arena as well. But he was introduced with had a walk-up song, basically. What was the song?
All Right Now by Free, the classic rock standard.
And what is that song?
It's a
classic rock standard.
Yeah. Just a classic
all
rock standard.
All right now.
Oh, I gotcha. I just wanted you to sing a little bit. That's perfect. That's
I fell for it.
That was Mike Pence's walk-up music. It's going to be your walk-out music.
There was also
music.
A lot of... And we actually could not stream the introduction or the pre-warm-up to the speech because they were playing a bunch of copyrighted material. Like Elton John was a big in the rotation before the speakers came up. So
it's always interesting, the music selections at some of these political rallies when they pick songs like All Right Now, which, you know, it has that line, which you're like, oh, yeah, that's a great line. All Right Now, we're in politics. We want to, when you dive a little deeper into the meanings of some of the songs.
Well, that's what makes these Trump rallies so very, very interesting because a lot of the music that is played there is not what you would expect. I think a lot of times you expect stuff that is very upbeat, very energetic, and he doesn't. He plays a lot of the slower, deeper cut Elton John stuff. Rolling Stones got a lot of hits. Celine Dion, there was a couple from her. Sarah Brightman. There's always a couple of opera from Pavarotti in there. It's a strange mix, and the only thing I can come up with is that they want people to save their energy for when he actually is on stage. They don't want getting people tired out cheering when there's nothing going on.
Though he did walk, Trump himself walked up to Lee Greenwood, so that was more on point.
Yeah, that's a little more typical, the Lee Greenwood classic. But a lot of times they were using Martina McBride's, Let Freedom Ring is a popular, Independence Day, I should say, is the name of it. And it's a standard at political rallies too, because it has that powerful Let Freedom Ring that she sings. But this is a song about a woman suffering domestic abuse and burning her house down. So I always found it curious that some of those songs make their way in just because of that one catchy line that they have.
Well, he ended this rally with the same song. He has ended every rally I've been to. The Rolling Stones, You Can't Always Get What You Want.
Well, we'll let that speak for itself. Bill Reinhart, thanks for coming in and chatting with us. We appreciate it. Scott, you're going to stick around because we're going to talk about the Banks and its new music venue that's coming. And we are also joined now by WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
I'm excited to be in the first part of the show.
Yeah. We usually only have mere crumbs of seconds left to talk about whatever you've reported on this week. Today, you're in the B slot.
Woo!
So there's movement, Tana, on the music venue at the Banks.
Allegedly.
Uh-oh.
We have a plan.
Okay.
So that's in place. They're still working on figuring out, all the deals and everything aren't signed, but there is a plan. There is... blueprints, I guess, are ready to go to build this music venue.
But there's some negotiation still to do, Scott.
Yes, yes.
So explain what's going on.
Well, there is a big piece of property that still needs to change hands.
The Hilltop.
Right. It's a concrete company right next to Paul Brown. And because of the lease signed 20 years ago between the county and the Bengals, the Bengals can demand certain things if the county wants to build right by the stadium. And the Bengals want this piece of property that a concrete company is on right now for parking to offset what they're going to lose with the music venue because it's being built on a parking lot. And they want the rights, if they so choose, to build an indoor practice facility. So they have not – the county, the city, and Hilltop have not worked out – a deal to relocate this company yet. The county has kind of downplayed it, saying like, oh, it's just a small step, but the city is not as rosy on this. So it's another example, again, of the city and county not agreeing, not even agreeing on the facts of the matter. So
And R.J. Hanselman here at WVXU reported this week also that there was an exchange of emails between, or at least some type of correspondence between attorney Tim Burke, who's representing Hilltop, to the deputy city solicitor. And in the deputy city solicitor in Cincinnati basically said, quote, this offer appears to move us further away from a resolution because it expressly ignores the city's consistent position that for the benefit of future generations, we do not wish to transfer riverfront land on a permanent basis. So that seems like it puts quite a wrinkle into the blueprints that you talked about, Tana. What did people have to say at the event this week where they were announcing all of this? Did they seem optimistic anyway?
With the exception of the city's attorney, who kind of was the one throwing cold water on the whole conversation, everybody there, like Scott was saying, seems pretty optimistic. They're going to get this done. You know, it'll happen. They've already started doing the test drilling on the site. The folks from Messer said, you know, all of this waiting on the deal making isn't going to really harm their timeline. I mean,
but
at this point,
can they move forward with any of the construction without this deal?
They have moved forward because the Bengals have allowed it to build a parking garage, but they still cannot. And the Bengals still said you can't go further than that until you have a deal in place to move this concrete company. So they can get a garage built as of now, but they beyond that, until they reach a deal with Hilltop. And how close they are on a deal again depends on who you ask. The county says it's not going to be a big deal, but the city's – and the city's solicitor said in no uncertain terms, he said in his words, that we are not close to a deal.
Did they give a timeline at all on when they would like to have this operating?
They did, but operating, like opening?
Yeah.
That's – well, fall of 2020.
Fall of 2020, next year.
So about 13, 14 months from now, they expect to have this operational music venue on the riverfront.
Correct.
Right.
Okay, so I'm curious then, if I may, get a sense from you all whether any of these people involved on the Banks music venue have expressed any concern about the fact that there's another one opening in Newport. So we're going to have a couple of music venues on both sides of the river to go along with our dueling Ferris wheels that we're going to have on both sides of the river as well. Any chatter about that at all in the context of this announcement this week?
I mean, there was one sort of offhanded comment, and Scott and I kind of looked at each other and said, which one of them said that? they did make a reference to the Newport it was event, but it was like a...
It was a virtual reality, a PowerPoint presentation just showing like a car coming across the bridge, what the venue would look like. And I wasn't sure who said it, but someone blurted out, is this coming from Newport?
Oh, I see. Okay. Well,
but kind of the behind the scenes chatter about it is they don't really seem too concerned about it. I guess the location, my understanding of the location on this Ovation site has a barrier between the river and where the music venue is.
I believe that they have said, though, that they are going to build it elevated so that when you're walking around the platform that they're creating for what would be the promenade of the Ovation site, is that it would be an unobstructed view.
Well, the Ovation site, yeah, that's going to be built on top of a parking garage, so nothing's going to be built below the flood wall. So I mean, I don't know exactly what it's going to look like.
This is what the argument has been both for the music venue and the Ferris wheels that are both coming, is that, well, our Ferris wheel in Cincinnati is going to be bigger, and Newport's will say, well, we're going to have the better view because we can see your Ferris wheel and your skyline. So
you literally have two – we're going to have a Ferris wheel and a music venue that are almost identical, just facing each other, just like glaring, you know, like a standoff.
Maybe we can get one of those like ski lift things to go between the two.
Well, that'd
that's
be
a
great
good idea. Or a zip line.
Yeah. Yes, a zip line. Let's do it.
Perfect. Well, let's zip up this segment. I appreciate both of you being here. Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Scott Wortman and RWVXU's Tana Weingartner. Thanks for coming in and chatting.
Well, thanks for having
You're
me.
Welcome.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. To help secure the site for its new stadium, FC Cincinnati signed a community benefits agreement with the West End Community Council. But how does it compare to other agreements and other soccer markets? And a pair of churches in that neighborhood may face the wrecking ball as well. The Friday News Review continues now with WCPO reporter Dan Monk. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you in person. We usually have to get you on the phone. Glad you could make it down to the studio today.
I'm happy to be here.
If you've got questions or comments for us, give us a call, 513-419-7100. So why don't we just start, Dan, by telling us again, even though we've kind of been over this a few times, but what the community benefits agreement is in general, and then specifically what's included here.
It's a contract between, in this case, the team and a community organization or the West End Community Council. There have been like 20 of these negotiated in various real estate development deals all over the country. It's a kind of a new idea, about 20 years old. And the people who promote the idea, these are economic justice advocates. The general idea is to have a real estate, when you're having a huge real estate development, it can impact all of the people that live on the site and around it. And so the goal of these agreements is to kind of mitigate the impact of a large project by having the developer deliver some kind of economic benefits. Oftentimes it has to do with affordable housing or anti-displacement, anti-gentrification measures. Sometimes there are job creation. Sometimes you see contract goals like minority inclusion on contracts, construction contracts, and in some cases in the MLS, they have actual operating contracts that are set aside for minority or women-owned businesses. So the whole idea is to mitigate the impact of a large development on the region where it happens.
And for Cincinnati specifically, what has the team come to with the West End Community Council?
Well, it's a 30-year agreement, and it includes a lot of the things we just talked about, like there are construction contract goals. There's an attempt to get jobs for West End residents. There's like a job training program that I think so far 10 West End residents have graduated from, and they've been offered jobs in the construction industry, including at least four on the stadium construction site. There are also a lot of things that the team pledged to do in terms of supporting youth soccer, not only in the West End, but outside the West End. And there's a $3 million commitment over 30 years to the FC Community Foundation. And the first $100,000 contribution of that went toward the immediate housing needs of people in the West End.
I read in your reporting that some critics have argued that these types of agreements aren't enforceable.
Well, what they argued was that FC Cincinnati's deal is not enforceable. And that's because there is a requirement in this contract that if the West End Community Council wants to proceed to binding arbitration, they have to get a 75% yes vote from something called the Community Coalition, which is a 17-member panel that was created by this contract to help implement the agreement. And FC Cincinnati does not have to get permission from the Community Coalition in order to force binding arbitration. Neither does the Port Authority. And then the third party to that agreement, the Community Council, does need that permission. And that, according to Julian Gross, who's an expert on CBAs, he's negotiated more than a dozen of these deals. He said that that's an impediment to enforcement, and it makes this deal, it's one of the factors that makes this deal difficult to enforce by the West End.
Has the team said one way or the other whether they believe that?
The team says it's enforceable. There is binding arbitration. I think they also say that this Community Coalition and the West End, the team is continuing to talk to the West End Community Council. They're talking to West End residents through this Community Coalition. And I think their argument is that if there is a problem, there are mechanisms for it to be addressed. What Julian Gross says is, in a normal contract, if you don't like what's going on, you can sue. They can't do that here. They have to go to binding arbitration. And in order to get to binding arbitration, they have to first clear that hurdle of a 75% vote of the Community Coalition.
You looked at other cities that have MLS teams and agreements with their communities. What did you find as they compare to Cincinnati's?
Well, I think Nashville and Cincinnati have the two that are the closest to what economic justice advocates regard as a community benefits agreement. It is a contract. It's an enforceable contract, one more enforceable than the other. And it's a contract with a community organization, not with a city or a local government. In the case of Austin, the team made a lot of community benefits promises through a city lease agreement. Miami has proposed a community benefits agreement, but it's also with the city. It's not with a community group. And Columbus has yet to do a CBA. They've made a lot of promises in their public statements and in a memorandum of understanding with the city, but it's not a true community benefits agreement. We also found that Cincinnati's agreement probably will cost the team less than in other cities. Austin's is more than $70 million. Miami is $25 million. Nashville is $75 million, according to the team, and Columbus is more than $50 million. And if you just add up all of the things that are in the Cincinnati agreement, it comes to $16 million, although the team says that it'll actually cost them more than $50 million if you count all of the things that are not identified, you know, by a specific cost.
But that's quite a disparity, almost $34 million between what you're able to calculate based on the figures provided in the agreement and what the team projects they will ultimately spend. So how do they reach their conclusions?
How does the team reach its conclusion? Well, they go through the one example is in Austin, one of their community benefits is a player development academy that they say will cost $36 million over 30 years. And Cincinnati is doing a player development academy. A lot of MLS teams do player development academies. And it's not required by their community benefits, but they're still doing it, and it's still likely to cost, you know, a similar total as Austin's, the way I understand it.
I think you started to mention a couple of these as pieces of evidence, but I'm wondering about progress so far in the agreement. What would people see in the neighborhood right now that they could point to as saying that's a result of the negotiation that the team did with the West End Community Council?
Well, there are contracts that are in place, you know, on the construction project. I think that the goal of the CBA is a 25% inclusion rate for minority-owned businesses. And right now, that's close to 30%, according to Turner Construction. At the end of June, they delivered some numbers to the Port Authority. And I think they're ahead of their goals on small business inclusion, and they're behind on the goal for women-owned businesses. But they've been telling the port and others that they're going to catch up as more contracts are awarded. I think they've only awarded $16.5 million worth of contracts so far, which is probably around 10% of the total budget. So as more contracts get awarded, they say those numbers are going to go up. The job training program is another example. They're working with CityLink to give people basic training on how to work on a construction site, and they emerge with a certification that has convinced companies, you know, that it's these folks are qualified to work in the construction industry. So they've graduated 10 people, all of whom received job offers, and they're going to have another one of these classes, I think, in September. And so, yeah, I mean, there are clearly benefits that are happening that are outlined in the CBA. And, the issue is whether, the CBA could be better. And, if they had followed some of the procedures that Nashville used, there would be a more robust, more enforceable community benefits agreement.
We've also learned through your reporting that a couple of historic properties, at least one historic property anyway, two religious buildings may face the wrecking ball.
Right. The historic property is the Revelation Missionary Baptist Church, which began its life in 1865 as one of Cincinnati's first synagogues. And it's actually the second oldest building that was constructed as a synagogue. The oldest was preserved and it's in it's near the Aronoff Center, and then the Plum Street Temple is third oldest. So two of the three have been preserved. This one, the Revelation Missionary Baptist Church decided to sell, and the team acquired the property on July 3rd. They requested a demolition permit from the city of Cincinnati. The other property is just north of the stadium site, the stadium construction site, and that belongs to the Jehovah's Witness congregation. They sold for $3.25 million to the Port Authority, but the deal was paid for by the team. The team bought the property, transferred it to the port, and the port told me after deadline, I added this information to the story after it ran, but the port told me that at least part of that site is going to be used for the stadium footprint itself, and it has to do with getting the pitch right. MLS, after they saw one of the final designs, asked for a design modification. So they're actually going to need a bigger footprint. So part of that Jehovah's Witness property will actually become part of the stadium site. And at least another portion of it, the team has said that they want to do handicap accessible parking there. But, you know, the team has been talking to the county about county-funded garages. They want some parking garages totaling 1,000 spaces, I think was the original promise. And they want them built as close to the stadium as they can get them. The county has talked about building one close to the stadium and another closer to Findlay Market. So there's still negotiation over the sites, and it's possible that one or both of these sites could be, you know, come a county-funded garage site.
Dan Monk from WCPO, thanks so much for coming in and explaining all that to us. Appreciate it very much.
Sure. Thanks.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. On the heels of the legalization of medical marijuana, Ohio has now given the green light to hemp and CBD. And one medical marijuana company is in the crosshairs of the state regulators. The Friday News Review continues now with Cincinnati Inquirer Columbus Bureau reporter Jackie Borchardt. Welcome, Jackie.
Great to be here.
So the governor signed this bill at the state fair. What was the significance of it?
Well, he signed it after a joint meeting with the Senate and House Agriculture Committees. And, of course, this bill was passed by both of those committees, and lawmakers who worked on the bill were present for it there. And I think, you know, signing at the fair, which is kind of the state's biggest celebration of agriculture, was also very intentional. You know, we're the 46th state to sign a law that allows hemp production, so we're certainly not a pioneer in this. But the state does seem ready, and did seem ready on day one to start the process of putting some rules in place, putting a program in place, so that next spring, farmers in Ohio will be able to plant their first hemp crops.
So who are the people who are expected to benefit from this?
Well, there's, of course, farmers. There is interest from small, medium, and large farmers in either adding hemp to their crop rotation to you know, maybe setting aside a small portion, a small number of acres to kind of test it out. But then there's also interest in new farmers, to call them that, because they will be growing plants, that haven't farmed before that want to start farming hemp. And there's basically two kind of purposes for growing hemp. One is to grow it for the fiber and the stalk, the seed. Pretty much any piece, any part of the hemp plant can be used in some way. And then, of course, there's hemp that is grown primarily for extracting CBD from its flowers, and that's in that instance, you're only growing female plants. You don't want any pollination, and so it's a much more controlled environment. So, I think the interest in this, I asked the Department of Agriculture what kind of interest they've been getting from farmers, and they basically just said a lot, and they haven't taken an extra step to kind of find out who these folks are that are calling the state saying that they're interested. But, you know, the details of who is going to be able to grow it, as far as what restrictions the state is going to put on, what requirements, because there is something in the law that says that there needs to be some sort of financial requirement to obtain a license. But it's not looking like it's going to be a situation like we have with the state's medical marijuana program. The Department of Agriculture Director Dorothy Planta has said several times in the last couple weeks that they don't intend on limiting the number of licenses that are available. The authors of the bill, of course, they also envisioned a low cost for these licenses, and the money is going to go straight into having inspectors that will keep track of these plants and make sure that they are purely hemp plants and not producing enough THC to be considered marijuana and therefore operating outside of the law.
Hemp is often conflated with marijuana, and that drives opposition in some places that have pushed to legalize the manufacturing of hemp products. Was there such opposition in Ohio based on that?
Yeah, you know, there were some lawmakers who voted against it who felt like this was, you know, kind of the next step in the legalization of marijuana. And, of course, hemp is a very different, it's the same plant, but it's a different program. It's a different, the state is approaching it very differently. I think, especially on this issue, the lack of education in the state house was one reason why Ohio has not been growing hemp since 2014, when the Farm Bill allowed states to do pilot programs where they would partner with universities or research institutions. And, you know, Kentucky, our neighbors to the south, have been growing hemp for several years, and they have six universities that have already been researching that long and trying to find the best methods to grow it, looking at seed, because that's very important. So, I think there just wasn't a lot of knowledge. And even because I started asking lawmakers about this back in December and January, and it was getting some blank stares or just, saying, I don't know. And I think, a lot of them learned a lot over the spring as this bill moved through the state house.
We have a medical marijuana company that appears to be in trouble. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so the company is called Harvest. They're an Arizona-based multi-state operator, so that means they have licenses in several states. And they applied for licenses to grow, process, and sell marijuana in Ohio under a couple different LLCs that are incorporated in Ohio. So the story that I wrote this week was pulling information from the Department of Commerce's case with them over their ownership, but they also have the Department of Pharmacy Board Ohio Board of Pharmacy is also looking into the same issue as far as who owns and controls their company. On their applications, they claim that a woman who's an African American woman from Northeast Ohio has 51% ownership of the company. And what the Department of Commerce found is that the company's internal documents, their operating agreement, and some other documents show that she didn't really have, according on paper anyway, a lot of oversight over the day-to-day responsibilities of running the business. And that's kind of... The Commerce Department has said that's their rule. It's not just that you have a majority ownership in the company. You also have to be the one who's, paying the bills and hiring people and running the whole company. So this actually was brought up in January, but the notice wasn't released until this week. And the agency says it is working with the company so that they satisfy the requirement of the law. And of course, this is a big deal because they got this license by having a black woman listed as the owner, they were an economically disadvantaged group under the state law, which meant that they skipped over a handful of companies to receive one of 12 large grow licenses.
Jackie Borkhart from the Cincinnati Enquirer Columbus Bureau, we appreciate you so much being on the show today. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Scooter Jeanette, Yasiel Puig, no longer Red. Cincinnati made some big moves this week ahead of the trade deadline. Let's talk about who we lost and who we got. Joining us for the last couple of minutes of the Friday News Review is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter C. Trent Rosecrans. C. Trent, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm no longer with the Enquirer. I'm with The Athletic, which is the website, sports website, national website.
I'm very familiar with The Athletic, and I know that you're with The Athletic, and I apologize for my misstatement on that. I've appreciated your work at both outlets. So see Trent Rosecrans with The Athletic, a very, very nice new publication that is doing a lot of great work. So now that we've wasted 30 seconds on my correction, let's move quickly to this topic, because it was a lot going on this week.
It was crazy. You had this huge brawl. You had Tanner Roark traded. You had Scooter Jeanette traded. And those were all the B stories, not the A story.
Okay, so who are we getting?
Well, Trevor Bauer is one of the most interesting pitchers in all of baseball. He was a top draft pick by the Diamondbacks. He was actually traded to the Indians in the deal that the three-way deal that brought Shin-Soo Choo to the Reds. And with the Diamondbacks, he has turned himself into one of the game's top pitchers. What is most interesting about Trevor Bauer is how he has gone about it. There's been a revolution in pitching analytics and how people study how they pitch. They use high-speed cameras. They use, like, pretty much portable radars. And it wasn't the teams that were at the forefront of this. It was Trevor Bauer, and the teams have been following Trevor Bauer, and his results have flourished with this. So it's a really interesting, he's almost the Joey Votto of pitching.
Oh, wow. And he had gone viral just days before the trade with that. He was being taken out of the game, and he got upset about it, and he hurled a ball all the way over the center field wall. And so he got a lot of attention, and I guess he made the joke that the ball landed in Cincinnati, and they told him to go pick it up and stay. So when will we see him?
Saturday.
I thought it was going to be Saturday.
Yes, and then we will see him for the first time in Cincinnati on Friday against the Cubs.
Okay, so we've got about 30 seconds left. What do these types of trades typically mean at this point in the season? Is this an effort to make a correction for the remaining games, or is it a look ahead to the future?
It's really to look at 2020 and try to position this team to win in 2020, not to be better, and that's kind of been what it was this year, was to be better. The last couple of years was to rebuild. This is to win in 2020.
See Trent Rosecrans from The Athletic. We'll look forward to your writing there. Thank you so much for taking some time with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
Later today, WVXU's Ann Thompson will join Jeremy Hobson on Here and Now. That show is broadcasting from our Corbett studio here at Cincinnati Public Radio this afternoon. That's Here and Now at 2 o'clock on WVXU. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.